Today is Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. This is part 9 of a Grand Canyon oral history interview with Nancy Mulady Meacham, last name spelled Mulady hyphen Mecham. My name is Tom Martin. Good afternoon, Nancy. How are you today?
Hi, I'm well. Thank you, Tom.
Great. Nancy, may we have your permission to record this oral history over the telephone?
Yes.
Thank you so much. Nancy, you'd mentioned quite a lot of fires, structural fires that you participated with. But also, you know, Grand Canyon's in a forest. Can you speak to me about the wildland fire work that you did?
I can. Especially early on in my career, right out of college, I became a wildland firefighter, and you go through specific training, and then you are red carded every season. And red carded entails physical fitness to a certain level. And it used to be something called the step test, where you'd step up and step down and step up and step down, and then they would take your heart rate. And then they decided that wasn't good enough, so then they put a 45-pound pack of weight on you and made you quick walk. I think it was a mile and a half or something. And you had to complete that, which didn't seem fair for someone like somebody might be 5'4" versus somebody was 6'2".
Right.
But that was the new thing in the future. So I remember specifically at my first season at Grand Canyon, you are required to have 40 hours of law enforcement refresher if you're going to continue to have either a level one or level two commission. The level one is permanents who've been to Federal Law Enforcement Training Center, and the level two are those who've been to the seasonal law enforcement academies. And so we were in there, and they came in and said, how many of you are red carded? And about six of us put our hands up, and they said, okay, you can finish your training later on. Come on, we have a fire on the Eastern Drive. And we went, wait a minute, I didn't sign up to be a wildland firefighter. I really didn't want to do it. It's hard work, it's dirty, it's all hours, it's dangerous, and I'd done it. I'd done it for 2 years, so anyway, I thought, shoot, why did I put my hand up? So we took us off, and then you're issued Nomex, and Nomex is fire resistant, not fireproof. It will burn. But it will slow the burn down, I guess. And so because of that, we are required to wear, for instance, Nomex anytime we're on the helicopter, or nothing that's polyester. We're not allowed to wear anything but leather boots on the helicopter in case we crash and there's a fire, to mitigate the amount of melting on you.
Mm-hmm.
So you get the Nomex yellow shirts, you get the pants, you get you have to wear certain boots, belts, you have a hard hat, helmet, and you have a, what I call a curtain. I don't know the real term for it, but it hangs down over your ears and your neck in case embers come down, and that's your hard hat doesn't cover that part, so that kind of saves you there.
Hey,
and
Nancy. I'm going to jump in here. So you start off with a law enforcement refresher, 40-hour class you were doing.
Right.
Do you remember the year? What year, month are we talking here?
We're talking 1991 June.
Thank you. 1991 June.
You're welcome.
And so you're in this training, and they say, all right, who's got a red card? And they gather you all up and send you out.
Yeah.
Then what happened?
Yeah. And then so I'm issued all of this stuff that I didn't have.
Oh, my.
Because I wasn't going to be a wildland firefighter anymore. That was not my job.
Right.
But it became my job. And so we were put on a crew, and I remember Kim, and I'm going to have to think twice for her last name here, but she and I, and then a few others, and we were put on a line crew. And so what that means is you go and you are given a particular tool, and there are three basic tools: the McLeod, which has a hoe at one end, I mean an axe at one end, and kind of a hoeing at the other side of it. Pulaski, you have, or the McLeod is a rake and a hoe on the other side, and then you have a shovel. And I was always an axe person, so I was given a Pulaski when I was with the Forest Service, and so off we go. And so you have a person spaced every 4 or 5 feet from the person, and you want to make a line around the fire to contain it. The fire's still burning inside, but you've contained it. Hopefully it won't spread. So you have to make a line getting rid of anything that's flammable down to mineral soil, 1.5 times wider than the height of the tallest flame that you can see adjacent to your line. So you do something
Wait. 1.5 times the fire you can see.
That's adjacent to the line. So if you've got a 30-foot flame,
right,
30 feet in, don't worry about it. But if you've got things burning and you're not putting a line necessarily 10 feet away from the fire, you're right on the fire.
Right.
When you're making this line. So you are, so let's say your flames are 6 inches tall. You want to make sure that the line you're making is 9 inches wide.
Okay. That makes sense. But if it's a foot high, that's 1.5 feet.
That's right.
And that could be, you know, you could be out there, you know, making sidewalks.
That's why I was more than happy not to cut line. I've cut enough line to go around the world when I was a wildland firefighter. So anyway, your job isn't to clear it completely. You do a certain amount, the next person line does a certain amount, the next person line does a certain amount. So ultimately, 5 or 6 of you clear that as you sort of walk like a caterpillar.
Hmm, okay.
Get that done.
Okay.
You're also taught to always carry your tools on the downhill side, so if you drop it, it doesn't roll downhill and knock your feet out from underneath you. So little things like that I still continue to remember. So we were sent somewhere on Eastern Drive, and I, to this day, I really can't tell you exactly where it was. But we went out there, and I had a white helmet, and usually you wear yellow helmets. I don't know how I ended up with a white hard hat helmet, but I did. It didn't signify anything. I wasn't in charge of anything. I was just a grunt.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were cutting line, and they really wanted to stop the spread of this fire. So we called them at that time borate bombers, because part of the effluent they put inside the ship to be released on the fire, and the whole purpose is to take the oxygen out of the air, because you need oxygen, fuel, and heat to make a fire. So you're throwing that on there. They realize that putting borax on the ground is detrimental to wildlife and the forest.
Mm-hmm.
But we called it borate bombers for the longest time, and the nickname for it was DAP, D-A-P. I'm sure it stood for something, but I'm not sure what. But so they could see where it landed. It was dyed pink, pinkish-orange color. So I had a little Instamatic camera, and this tells you how long ago it was, a little Instamatic box camera with film in it, not digital.
Mm-hmm.
And so we'd cut a line. They said, okay, clear the line, you know, the borate bomber's coming in. And, again, it wasn't borax anymore, but that's what we called it.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically fertilizer, colored fertilizer. And here comes this big C-140 or whatever it was, and it opens up the bay, and I got my camera ready to take the picture. And I said, it's released too soon. And I've got several pictures of the pink fertilizer falling down right on top of us.
Wow.
So it fell on us. That's heavy stuff. So we all curled up in little balls and tried to get as little as we could, but we were just blasted. And we were pink. We stunk. It was awful.
Wow.
So I still have that helmet that's turned pink.
My gosh. And nobody got hurt, I hope.
No, but it was just more of a, I mean, we're always talking about escape routes and safety and how to deploy your shelters and all that kind of stuff. And one of the things that I did learn at the Grand Canyon, and I was resistant to it, but it was a foolish resistance, is that as the years went by and the climate changed and wildland fires became more common, there was no avoiding being a part of wildland fire as a protection ranger.
Hmm.
Because if you're on the structural fire, you're doing urban interface, you still have to know how to use the shelters in case the forest fire, while you're protecting the house, is overwhelming you.
Yeah. Okay.
So we used to do training in front of the Shrine of Angels, where it used to be the simple training is you have these shelters. You put your feet in a strap at the bottom. You put your hands in the strap in the top. It's a rectangular shelter. And you flop it down, hopefully capture some oxygen in there, and the fire burns over you and doesn't burn you.
Mm-hmm.
Well, what they used, and we were really good at this, and then somebody, and I don't know who it was, but it was very clever of them, and it was real life. They made us trained to do this in front of a big fan that we had on top of the engine for clearing smoke
out
of the building.
Oh, wow.
Because that's real, because you're on a fire, things are swirling around, and there's wind. It makes its own weather. And it was much harder to deploy those shelters in this. And we learned after that to put our feet down and our butts toward the wind. I mean, it was really, really good training before we really didn't do anything. But you're supposed to clear the ground below you so you don't have anything flammable underneath you. But that was really good training, I thought. And later on, I thought, well, if I'm going to stay with this, then I took all of the necessary coursework to become a medical unit leader.
Hmm.
And a medical unit leader in the we have a logistics, resources, medical unit, supply. You have all these different departments within Wildland Fire in the organizational hierarchy. And you take these classes and you learn what the hierarchy is and you learn what your job is. And so I have been a paramedic on a fire as a single resource. I was sent to California when I was in Arizona and other places. And but a medical unit leader is the person who doesn't necessarily take care of the patients, but deploys the resources underneath them, orders what they need, interfaces with the incident command post about updates and all that kind of stuff. So
mm-hmm.
I became more of an administrator.
Mm-hmm.
I think sort of defend myself from cutting any more line. I'm not sure.
Well, it would make sense. You had the skills. I mean,
yeah. And so on one particular fire, on the North Rim, I was sent over to be the medical unit leader on a fire. I'm afraid I couldn't tell you the year, but it was, I want to say 96 or 97, but I'm not 100% sure what year it was. And I was the medical unit, and they had a lot of people there, and I had my medics deployed at coyote camps, and coyote camps are camps where they go out and they are by themselves as a single resource for a bunch of firefighters. They're not coming into camp every night, for instance.
Okay.
And in the North Rim, left over from the days of when they put out fires, and I learned a lot being at the Grand Canyon, and I even did a program on it, but there were ladders up trees, that very, very tall ponderosa pines that you climbed up them, and I have a picture of me up in the tree. And that's how you looked out for fires.
They oh, interesting.
Have fire towers everywhere. So you went up these ladders that were literally nailed into trees. They were metal ladders. And one of the things, and I have a film that's, I think, from 1908. I have a copy of it that I used to use for part of my program. And what it was is the policy back then was Gifford Pinchot, the U.S. Forest Service, protect the resources. They didn't think of ecology. They didn't think of protecting the processes of nature. They wanted individual trees saved.
Right.
So as soon as the fire started, it was put out as fast as they could. And there was only one, maybe two ranger the entire summer on the North Rim, for instance.
Wow.
And so what they did is it was to the benefit of the people who owned the land. And so all of these rangers that were there, cowboys that were there, ranchers that were there, farmers, they all went and fought the fire. And I have a film of people riding up on horseback, getting off with their shovels, with their bandanas over their face, putting out a fire with the cowboy boots on.
Wow.
Huh. It's pretty cool.
Yeah.
And until we realized that the processes of nature, we messed up by putting out the fires. But it's
right.
A learning process.
So when I think of nailing a ladder to a tree, one of the things that makes a ladder work is that when I put my foot on the rung, I can kind of catch the heel of my shoe, which means that my forefoot, where my toes are in the toe box of the shoe, usually sticks out in the front of the ladder. But if the ladder is tied to a tree, that...
It's not tied to the tree. Yeah, what it is there are brackets that give it about a 3-inch clearance from the tree each one of the rungs.
Oh, it did. So they thought about that. Okay, awesome.
Yeah, and these were big trees. So this ladder is about the width of my shoulder or hips.
Wow.
Because of the picture of me, you can see it's a pretty sizable ladder and a pretty sizable tree. It's really tall.
And at the very top of that ladder, was there like a nice branch you could sit on? or a little platform
they
or something?
No, they'd cut the branches up, so you're just going up the side of the tree.
Okay.
And then you're looking around. You're not even at the top of the tree.
Wow.
You're just maybe 100 feet, 150 feet off the ground.
And you're still just hanging on your ladder in the free air.
I'm hanging on to my ladder. Yeah,
okay. Wow.
And then I thought, wow, what a great view.
Climb back down.
I'm really fortunate to not have a fear of heights. They say that the two greatest fear of human beings is a fear of heights and fear of public speaking. And I used to give talks on top of Morrill Rock and say that. And I said, well, I guess that's not me.
Yeah. Oh, very fun.
Yeah. But the other fun thing, and I know this, I have a picture of this in, I know in one of my programs, but we used to go as firefighters. Oh, and I think I mentioned this already, and go to the elementary school at Grand Canyon dressed up as firefighters, both in wildland and in our SCBA, so the kids could see us so they wouldn't be afraid of us when we came to rescue them in there.
Oh, cool. That's a great idea.
Yeah, so they could see us as Darth Vader friends, not Darth Vader evil.
Yeah, cool.
Yeah. So that's the wildland fire, and it was a small part, any chance I could to not do wildland fire. I think because I just did that in one summer for sure. That's all I did.
Hmm.
Campaign fires, everything for the Forest Service. The next year I was backcountry ranger, made trails, but fought fires as needed. And it just wasn't anything that interested me.
Okay.
But we had to do we had to have our red cards, and it really... and I think I talked to you as my physical therapist about this. I said, I've got this 45-pound pack, and we're not allowed to run. We have to walk and pound around Hermit Circle.
Right.
Park Circle. We were doing Park Circle like three
was
times.
Was it? You have 45 minutes to walk a mile?
Yeah.
Is
and
that right?
I think a half.
Maybe
something
it was.
Like that.
Yeah.
And so you just really had to keep moving. And I did it. That was not the issue. The issue was as I hurt afterwards because
right.
I had cartilage issues and stuff.
Right.
And it just wasn't, to me, it wasn't as fair as the step test, which was kind of individual, or a VO2 test, which is a volume of oxygen that they measure after you do something. The whole point is, can you escape from a fire?
Right.
And it seems to me, and one of the things they teach you with a wildland fire is you don't escape with your tools.
Exactly.
You just drop and
exactly.
you go. So they're putting this weight on you to up your... to make you use more oxygen in this hike, and they never take into account that you're at 7,000 feet
right.
or gender.
Right.
So that was not...
Exactly.
It just wasn't right, and I was breaking my knee for nothing.
It's not appropriate
measure.
Size. As you say, different people, different heights, different body masses, so there's no appropriate mass slide index for that. Okay, so you're 5'6", you weigh 130 pounds, we're going to give you a 30-pound pack. I mean, just, you know, no, you're 6'6", you weigh 220 pounds, here's your 45-pound pack.
So you had some 6'2" guy wearing 45 pounds, who's 240 pounds, and
right.
I'm wearing the same thing. It just wasn't...
That's right.
So
that's right.
We were not happy about that.
No, as you should not have been,
But we also had to do the PEB, the physical equivalency battery.
I think
it was twice a year.
Right.
So we go to the track at the school, and we run around, and we do... you know, obstacle courses and sit-ups and push-ups, and they measure your percent of body fat. And that was fine. That
mm-hmm.
was not a big deal. But the wildland fire is what hurt my knee. The
mm.
the red card, getting the red card. And I thought, geez, this is nonsense. Give me the step test again. They wouldn't do it.
Right. And at that point, you're like, well, I'm just not even going to try for this. And, you know.
Well, but I didn't have a choice. We didn't have a choice. If we were on the structural fire brigade, we had to be red guarded.
Interesting.
Yeah, because of the urban interface.
Got it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Huh.
Which is unfortunate.
Right, yeah. So to pass that, you have to just pound yourself.
Which I did, and you saw the result.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Yes, indeed. Gee.
So,
wow.
Anyway, that was the North Rim. And then, but I think one of the funnest things I did was horse patrol. And I don't know if it's time to segue into that. Or
it is.
Okay. Grand Canyon was one of the few places that had a horse patrol program. Off the top of my head, Yellowstone and Yosemite were the others, and there was a school at Yosemite specific for that, and the head of the horse program at the Grand Canyon was a man named Ronnie Gibson, G-I-B-S-O-N, and he was very knowledgeable. And it was pretty much, if he could get people to go to the Yosemite School, he would do that.
Okay.
But if you couldn't, he would teach you the processes. And there were people who'd never been on a horse before, but then he got to know me and got to see me around horses and realized I've been riding since I was 3 years old.
Hmm.
And all the time, and I used to work for a large animal veterinarian, and I was still a large animal veterinary tech, so I assisted him in giving them their shots and penicillin and cleaning them up and
cool.
all that kind of stuff. Kent Keller was also very, very knowledgeable around horses, and
okay.
you'd get them all good for looking good for parades and things like that. So once I learned what they wanted me to do, for instance, with horses, you have to be very detail-oriented and try to do things in the same order every single time, and that gives their cooperation to you.
Yes.
In that they're not surprised. They're not the sharpest knife in the drawer, but the day they find out that they are 1,500 pounds to your 130 pounds, you're in trouble.
Right.
And so, for instance, when I would take one of the horses out that we were continuing to have a little bit of training, we would, go down to where the train was, and I would sit there on the horse while the steam train down below the El Tovar would let loose its brakes, sound, and I would stand there, or I would have a little rodeo, and I would train the horse that behavior wasn't appropriate, and after a while, we'd ride down there, and it realized they weren't going to get hurt. I would ride on purpose down a trail where other rangers would be waiting for me, and then they would wave big plastic garbage bags in its face. And so you'd learn that. I was riding a horse one time toward the Maswick, and buried in the asphalt there is a railroad track. And one day, Simmy just did not want to walk across the railroad track. For whatever reason, it just wasn't going to happen. I'd go left, go right, wouldn't do it. So if you have a newbie, you don't know what to do, but I just reined right and made it go in a circle three times, reined left, made it go in a circle three times, and then we went straight ahead, and it was so dizzy, it just went across the track. So you just sort of learn after a while how to deal with it.
Yeah.
So I love training the horses. I love taking care of them. I love riding the horses, and it was public relations number one.
Hmm.
People, that is their vision of a park ranger. You've got the flat out, you're on the horse. And that's mostly what we did was public relations. And it was a wonderful thing to be riding along the rim and have people take your picture. And you tell people where to stand right by the front leg. And they could stand and get their pictures taken while you're on the horse.
Cool.
It just really is fun. You know, sometimes you'd go to a medical. I worked a rather severe assault case on a horse. I was at the riding just on horse patrol through the parking lot of the general store that was there, and I heard some pretty bad language coming from a man and a woman, and I looked over, and she whacked him in the head with something, jumped in the car and locked all the doors, and he's pounding and pounding on the doors, and the language is just awful, and it's growing a crowd, so I come up on my horse, and I walk up, and I said, park ranger, and he's still pounding on the door. And I said, so I inched up and said, I said, park ranger. So pretty soon I was right up in front of him with my horse that was very well trained. And I said, turn around. And he had 1,500 pounds of horse flesh about an inch away from him.
Hmm.
And so he and his wife had a domestic, he hit him in the head with a camera, and he called her this. And there were kids in the car. And I stayed with them for a long time, probably an hour and a half, calling for backup and all this stuff. I never got off my horse because that was my advantage.
Yes.
In this particular case.
Huh.
And I told him, I said, I can call Child Protective Services. Your kids can go away. This is supposed to be a vacation. You guys need time apart. So you're just an ombudsman and all this stuff. And I said, you could go to jail. Lining out all the evil things that could happen so that by the time I tell them the easiest thing that they can do to get rid of me, is to calm down, let's talk about it with each other, make sure the kids are okay, and then everybody's on their way. And by the way, feel free to leave the park at any time, like within the next 30 minutes, or I might have to cite you for disorderly conduct.
Mm.
So then it's they realize that what they've done, and they could get a ticket, their kids could be taken away, they could go to jail, or they could calm down and leave the park.
Right.
So that's the thing that sometimes you do on that. Also on horse patrol, I remember I was on going out toward the sewage treatment ponds one time, and I could smell decay, rotting body decay. And it was very sad because I came across one of our Roosevelt elks, which are not native to the Grand Canyon. The native elk to southern Arizona are the Miriam's elk, which were kind of a smaller elk. And they were extirpated. They were wiped out by the hunters. And hunters, I guess, wanted elk again, so they imported from the Montana-Wyoming region these gigantic Roosevelt elks to southern Arizona. And slowly but surely over time, they worked themselves into northern Arizona. And so here was these huge elks that didn't belong in the park, but people still wanted to hunt them. And the ones in the park were not hunted, and so they got bigger. They had all these different points on their antlers, and there is a designation called Boone and Crockett for hunters to get really nice trophy heads. But again, you can't hunt in a national park. So one of the things I discovered that day is they would take salt blocks, which we are in a salt-poor environment at the Grand Canyon, and these animals can smell it on the wind as it evaporates. And so they would go next to the fence and lick through to get at it or jump over the fence. But this one in particular was about 30 feet away from the fence when it was shot and killed.
Wow.
And then somebody decapitated it, jumped back over the fence, and took the head with it.
Oh, gee.
Covered it up with some stuff. So there was poaching in the park, unfortunately.
Hey, Nancy, you mentioned Ronnie Gibson and Kent Keller. Can you give me a thumbnail sketch of what you recall about Ronnie and Kent?
Yeah, Ronnie, both of them very nice people. Ronnie, very knowledgeable. He would, I think if he had to describe himself, he would be a cowboy.
Mm-hmm.
He had a mustache that went down the side of his house, and sandy brown hair at the beginning, and then salt and pepper at the end. He also was the DARE officer, which is the go to school and teach the kids not to use drugs.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a talker. The thing we used to make fun of Ronnie, even in front of him, is that nobody else got a word in edgewise. I'm talking and I can't shut up, you know. But he's a raconteur, and he told stories, and he just loved and loved and loved to talk.
Hmm.
So very knowledgeable on horses. And so he was the go-to guy. Kent Keller, I can't tell you, I think he's from Texas originally, I can't remember exactly. He was sort of the opposite, quiet, calm, married Tammy Leplo, who became Tammy Keller.
How do you spell Tammy's last name?
Her maiden name is Leplo, L-U-P-L-O-W.
Thank you.
And so she became Tammy Keller. And the interesting thing is, I remember Karen Schenkel, who was a dispatcher one time, saying, I got a call the other day for somebody who wanted to talk to the paramedic that took care of them. But it was a lady paramedic, and she was married to somebody named Kent. Well, both of the lady paramedics were married to somebody named Kent.
Right.
Kent Keller and Kent Meekum.
Yeah.
So that didn't help her much at all, so she got more information and ended up being me. So.
Okay.
But that was kind of a funny little coincidence there.
Hmm.
But Kent Keller, he was assistant shift supervisor, and then a shift supervisor, and then he went on special details for things, and then I would become the shift supervisor acting. He was easy to work with, a fair supervisor. I enjoyed working with him.
Nice.
Yeah. Nice. No, Ronnie was not in my chain of command. Ronnie worked through the Office of Investigations after we had an Office of Investigations. Before that, he was on the South Rim Patrol. He was on the shift that I was on.
Okay.
So he was as much a South Rim Patrol Ranger as I was until he became the DARE officer and later worked out of the Office of Investigations, as I recall.
Okay. All right. Sorry, I interrupted there. You were talking about poaching in the park. I would assume, in quotes, that it's very rare, but it may not be. Were there other incidences of poaching?
Yeah, there were quite a bit of that, and to the point where later on in the 90s, some of the rangers from the night shift, I will try to remember, I can see his name. I can see his face, but I can't think of his name. He got special training in poaching, went to a class or something, and was able to purchase a deer that looked like a deer, but it was a mechanical deer that kind of moved its head and made its tongue, and they set it up to capture poachers. And so they did Cole, last name of Cole, and then they also had, they expanded into bike patrol. John, somebody or other, also went to classes, so we had bike patrol on the South Rim, so there was a chance to do that. But I wasn't interested in a bike patrol because it would take away from horse patrol.
Got it.
And the night shift summer people are the ones who were more interested in catching poachers. So I do believe they tried to. I don't know if they were successful in doing that, but they went through that. But also on a horse patrol, I was riding through the South Rim over behind the area where they now have the new Mather Center. Over the between that and the housing area, I came across a wikiup, which is a shelter of branches and stuff that I was not new to me at all. And so I contacted archaeology. I think it was Jan Balsam and Ellen Brennan came out, and they said it was probably about 80 years old.
Wow!
So that was kind of neat to see that.
Neat.
And the other good thing about being on horse patrol is your fluidity. You could be one place and gallop to another place pretty instantly, and so it was, but mostly post public relations. I felt like I belonged when I was on the horse. I felt like horses, to this day I still lead in the summertime backcountry seminars for Rock Creek Pack Station, so they're still a very important part of my life.
Cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. And then you I'm assuming you'd have to take care of the saddle and
yeah, we would saddle soap and sharpen everything up, and your boots would be sharp. And when we would come in for horse patrol, we'd come in, and whoever was the early ranger usually fed the horses two flakes, which is a known measurement, and you put it in a particular feeding trough so that horses could get at from either side. Horses have a hierarchy, and if you just put it in one bin, one horse would eat it so the other couldn't get it.
Oh.
So you put it in this long trough which has bars on it, so you throw the flakes in at different places so one horse can eat while the other eats and they're not competing with each other.
Got it.
And then when it's time for patrol, you come in and you lock your gun in the car. This is how I would do it. I would go and put on my green overalls over my uniform, because now you're getting this horse that is rolled in manure and rolled in the grass and stuff, or grass or the dirt. We have grass down there. Bring them up, tie them up to the fence. Then you'd brush them, curry comb them, groom them, trim their eyes. And then if you needed to, you gave them a bath, but usually you didn't at this time unless you were going in a parade. You clean the hooves. And you would pick up each hoof individually, and you'd pick it out around the frog, which is the area at the bottom of the foot with a pick, and make sure there's nothing wrong with them. If you saw any cuts, you put purple stain on it. That's what we called it. You also, there were a lot of fly problems and gnats, and so you would spray special spray on them, or you'd have a rodeo, as I like to say, and then you would wipe it around their faces, and I'd talk to them and let them know who I was, and you know, pretty soon after a while, and you just go down like after work and just go talk to the horses, because they were 100 yards from my house, so I'd go down and visit all the time. You bring a carrot or some sugar or something.
Cool.
And they know who you are.
Yeah.
And they get to know you. So after you've done all of that and all that dirty, grungy work, then you take your coverall off and you put your uniform back on, and you really are spit and shine. You are, your boots are shined, your duty belt is shined, you're looking good, because this is the public. And we also had special whistles. Looking at mine right now across the room. It's special whistles that went underneath the epaulette on your shirt and into your shirt pocket so that you could blow that whistle. And it was given to you by Ronnie Gibson once you passed his course and you were an official horse patrol ranger.
Okay.
And so
What would you do with the whistle on?
The whistle's on a lanyard.
Okay.
And the lanyard is worn over your shoulder and under your armpit, but
okay.
It doesn't slide off your arm because there's an epaulette
that
buttons on the top of each of our uniform shirts.
Right, right.
And then that whistle would be in my pocket. So if I had to control, crowd control, I could blow a whistle, I could do all kinds of stuff. There was a woman who was a ranger who wanted to be a harder core, more police ranger, who actually wanted to run radar from a horseback. And none of us said, no, that's not what we're here for.
Huh.
She was really into horses and she wanted to do everything she could from them. But
yeah.
But that was inappropriate and it would take away from the positive. It's one of the more positive.
Oh, right. It's an image thing. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, not that I didn't write people parking tickets. You know, as I'm riding along, my pet peeves were people without insurance and people parked in disabled parking areas. So I would cite those.
Right.
But
and certainly if someone was speeding and you were in your patrol car and you had your radar going, you'd go get them.
You know what? When I did that, I rarely gave tickets for that. What I did is I educated them.
Mm.
And this is, for instance, on Eastern Drive, there was a dead cougar cub that was hit by a car.
Mm.
And unfortunately, I didn't catch the person who did it. But this little cougar cub probably weighed about 20 pounds.
Oh.
And we have a speed limit of 35. You can easily go faster on those roads, but the speed limit is for you to have reaction time for the wildlife.
Right.
And so when I would have somebody on Center Road or Eastern Drive or something speeding, I would pull them over, and I would I would go to the driver's side door so I wouldn't be taken off by a car in the roadway.
Mm-hmm.
And I would talk across and educate them, almost to the point where they'd say, write me the ticket, don't tell me this stuff, you know. But I would, if they're in such a hurry to get somewhere, I would delay them 5 to 10 minutes to explain why it was that way. And the longer I was in the job, the fewer tickets I wrote because I thought education was more important.
Mm-hmm.
Tickets to me became important when people were not paying attention to what you were saying and you had to get their attention. So hitting people's wallet got their attention.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. But that took some maturity on my part. It took me a couple of years to get to that point.
And I would think that as you grow in your job as a law enforcement and also, you know, you start to time out as, you know, body is starting to ache and pain with things, it does change how you approach the public and infractions in the park or outside the park.
Hmm. Yeah. I would think, but one of the things that they made very clear to us is they wanted a young and vigorous workforce. So that's why people in the National Park Service who are in structural fire, wildland fire, or protection, law enforcement, are required to retire between the ages of 55 and 57.
Well, it's like trail crew as well. I mean, it's hard to find someone on the trail crew that's over 55. They're there, a few and far between, but boy, they're hurting, and it's a very hard, demanding job.
It is. And the problem with that, by forcing you to retire, there was no enhanced retirement at the first part of when I was there. So people had to retire, but then they had to wait 10 years to get any pension.
Oh, wow.
Until they were 65.
Right.
So then they started charging us extra out of our paycheck every month to get enhanced annuity, meaning that we could start getting paid at 55 or 57.
Oh,
but they took more of our paycheck to do that.
Hmm.
There's also a period of time, I'm going to check something time-wise. Yeah, I'm going to tell this story. When we, for a short period of time on South Rim in the afternoon 90s, I want to say it was 96, 7, or 8, I can't remember exactly, but somebody who came in decided that we needed to have a union. And so the South Rim Patrol Rangers, I don't know how it happened, I voted for a union, and then we were unionized. The advantage of having us unionized was that administration could not arbitrarily do stuff to us without asking our permission. For instance, I had very specific days off where I had Sunday, Monday off. But because I was not an administrator, they could not just say, Nancy, you're now going to have Friday, Saturday off. They had to ask my permission. And I had had Sunday, Monday off. Those were the days off my husband had off. Kent and Yeekum, Sunday, Monday off. And I didn't want to change mine because, you know, when you go to night shift, that's the only time you see each other.
Right.
So we got a new supervisor. His name was Dave Brennan. And Dave Brennan decided that one of the first things he was going to do was to save a lot of money. And by getting people off of Sundays would save a pittance of money, but he was going to do that. So he said to Kent Keller and I, who had Sunday, Mondays off, he goes, I need one of you to change your days off. And Kent said,
Wait, I'm sorry. I'm confused because if you were off on Sunday, how did that cost more?
Sunday differential. I'm sorry. I misspoke. You're right. I worked Sunday, Monday, and had Friday, Saturday off. You are right.
Got it. I'm sorry.
Thank you. So I got paid Sunday differential by working Sunday.
I see.
Thank you for that clarification. Woof, that would have been a difficult thing. So at least you're listening to me.
No, I'm going, wait a minute.
He wanted me to
differential.
Have,
what is that?
Yeah, he wanted me to have Sunday, Monday off, and I didn't want that.
I see.
And I wanted to continue to work. Kent Keller and I were the most senior, and we both got to work Sunday, Monday. And we both respectfully declined, and he couldn't force us to move our days off because we were now protected by this union. And so it was not too long after that I was working a call. I was on night shift, and it was the wintertime, and we had a really bad snowstorm, and cars were into ditches, and just past, just before Eastern Drive turnoff, there was a car in a ditch, and I pulled up in my patrol car, and in answer to Jim Coffey, who was the Department of Public Safety, no, and he wasn't DPS, he was a Coconino County Sheriff deputy, who says, I got a car in a ditch here. And I said, okay, because we had concurrent jurisdiction at the Grand Canyon, meaning that other law enforcement agencies had the right to do law enforcement.
Okay.
In there. So Coconino County had as much right to go after their cases as other things. And we just helped each other out.
And with concurrency, did that work both ways? I mean, if you were out in Tucson and you saw someone doing, you were out in the county outside the park.
That's where the MOU came from, the Memorandum of Understanding.
Okay.
Concurrent, it's exclusive, concurrent, or proprietary of the three jurisdictions that national parks have.
Mm.
And so for, if it's exclusive, in theory, nobody else can come from the outside in and do anything.
Oh, okay.
Sequoia is like that. Yellowstone is like that. Yosemite may, but I'm not sure.
Hmm.
Concurrent means that outside agencies can come in without asking permission if they are enforcing their laws.
Okay.
And then proprietary means the Park Service really can only write tickets. They don't. They can't investigate things. They can't follow murder investigations. It's all sheriff or whoever's the law on the land.
Huh.
So those are the three levels. But we were concurrent at Grand Canyon.
Okay.
So anyway, I pull up behind him, and the road is really icy. So I gingerly walk my way to his car and then down to the ditch. And it's like four kids I know from high school. And And I'm not going to say their names because they were juveniles at the time. But I said, what are you guys doing out here? He says, we're going to Tucson for pizza. And I said, no, you're not anymore. So, you know, we'll get your ride home and all this stuff.
Uh-huh.
I said, you can come back and get the car later on. We'll get you home. Nobody's hurt. Okay, the car's fine. So I went back to my car. And then I started back down. And I slipped on the ice. And I overcorrected. And I fell down on my knee.
Ooh.
Right on the knee, and I saw stars. I almost said a bad word, and Jim was right there and saw me, and he came over, and he goes, are you okay? He said, that was a bad fall. I said, oh, my leg, oh, God. So I gingerly walked back and forth and everything. So we got the kids a ride home, and I finished my shift, and the next morning I woke up, and my leg was really swollen. So I walked a mile to the clinic to get it x-rayed. I think about 10, 11 in the morning when I got up. And it was fractured. The tibial plateau fracture with some chunks off. And so I'd walked a mile and finished my shift with a broken leg.
Mm-hmm.
And so I had to have some surgery and everything. But anyway, sometime later, I'm on the couch, and Kent comes home livid, just livid. And I said, what? And he goes, well, he wasn't protected by the union. He was a in a separate thing, being the fire chief and all. His immediate acting supervisor was a man named Ken Phillips. And Ken Phillips arbitrarily, it seemed at that moment, changed Kent's days off to Sunday, Monday. Because he wasn't protected, he had to do that. And he argued with him and argued with him. He goes, no, that's it. The next thing I know, Dave Brennan has contacted me and says, now that your husband's days off are Sunday, Monday, would you like to voluntarily change yours?
Huh.
That's how he got around me not wanting to change my days off. And so he had worked with Ken Phillips to make this happen. And that I don't mind tailing that names because these two individuals were not pleasant to work with or for. And instead of helping the people to make the operation work, they screwed the people in an effort to make the operation work. And it was very sad when those things happened. So, yes, I did change my days off. I lost my Sunday differential so I could have days off with Kent. But I hear him on the couch with a broken leg, and that's the time he picked to do that.
Wow.
So, knowing that I wasn't in a position to stomp in his office and object to all of that.
Right.
So that gives you an idea that sometimes at Grand Canyon, they eat their young, as I like to say. Some bad things happen to the operations there, and it's a sad thing.
Very sad. Yeah. And but, I can't help but think that things like this happen in the private sector, all across the country. But you know, it is difficult when you hear about it in the National Park Service.
I think in this private sector that, and I've worked in the private sector, that there are all kinds of protections for people to learn to know to do what their job is. You know, in the National Park Service, people are promoted into positions that they're not trained or qualified for. And so it's my observation that middle management in the National Park Service is not well-equipped to handle supervisory positions unless it's in their personality to take care of people.
So
people flail, and that there's a reason that we have the senior executive service. These are people who are handpicked by the government to become superintendents of the crown jewels of the National Park Service. It's
right.
Not Joe Blow that's worked his way up the line. These are people that they see have political savvy. They have public relations savvy. They go through these special training. And you put somebody in Yosemite, Yellowstone, Grand Canyon, Grand Tetons, they better have the chops to deal with the public, to deal with problems in the park and all kinds of stuff, which is why a lot of these places have deputy superintendents to deal with inside the park. Unfortunately, everybody below that, for the most part, they are not recruited from the outside to be that person. They are recruited
to be managers,
to be managers. They are recruited from the field.
Yeah.
And so they don't really often know what they're doing.
Right.
And it's very sad, or have the personalities to be managers.
Right.
That's my observation anyway. And it's, I have to say that I've been in parks where it's been really good. Sequoia, it's been good.
Right.
Death Valley, it's been good. Grand Canyon, boy, out in protection and interpretation, it was just fine. But in protection, it just was like forever. I mean, I was there for 18 years, and this was a forever problem.
Interesting.
Middle management. And then the middle management weren't trained to nip things in the bud to stop discrimination. I was an EEO counselor for Grand Canyon. I even wrote the EEO booklet, Equal Employment Opportunity.
Thank you.
Counselor. And this is somebody who, if somebody feels they've been discriminated against because of a specific class of gender, race, orientation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, they, and they haven't been able to resolve it, they find one of the handful of EEO counselors, which is a collateral duty, and say, I've been wronged. And so my job is to sit down with this person, not at all be an ombudsman at all, but to be the go-between administration and the complainant. And so I would take down everything, and then the last thing I would ask this person is, what would it take to make you whole again?
Okay.
Let's say that somebody was, and this is an example, this did not happen, but let's say somebody repeatedly walk into the shared office, and there was a calendar with nude women on it, let's just say.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt that that was a an undesirable workplace environment. And so, and they asked the person, hey, you know, that offends me, please take it down, and they wouldn't. So they would come in, and they'd say, they're not listening to me, I can't do this. And I said, what would it take to make you whole? He goes, just to take the calendar down.
Right.
And to not yell at me, you know, if that has to happen. Okay. So then I would go to my, the deputy superintendent, oh, his name just went right out of my head, but you know his name.
Not JT, or who was?
JT Reynolds.
Oh, JT Reynolds, right,
JT Reynolds.
Okay.
He was the guy, and I would talk to him, and I said, this is the situation and all this kind of stuff. This is, and I had, but at that time I went to an investigation. I went and saw that there was a calendar. I went inside, presented everything to him, and then he would deal with it or have somebody deal with it.
Okay.
And then we would write up a contract between the offending parties. And so I promised to take my calendar down and not have retribution to the person who complained about this. And the person said, I am satisfied that this makes me whole and that I don't feel sexual. I live in a sexual harassed environment in VOR, and I will not take any further action.
Hey,
they,
Nancy.
All, everybody signs it.
You mentioned that you've got something that has to happen at 10 after 2. I've got some more questions about this.
Okay. Do you want to get back to this next time?
I'm just asking you how much more time you have.
No, I have about, you know, 10 more minutes, but I...
Ooh, okay, good, good. Then,
so
then I'll ask this follow-on question, which is, how well did that work, the contracts? Did that, because it seems as though, as you mentioned, it's almost, you know, 2 decades of problems continuing at Grand Canyon, and so I'm kind of questioning, gee, did this thing work or not?
Well, number one, the EEO counselors, and there were 3 of us, Kim Beeson, myself, and I can't remember the 3rd one. And I trained Kim, and I trained myself by going to, I went to Cheyenne, Wyoming with, her name will come to me. I worked with her at Sequoia as well. But she worked in Eastern Drive. So we actually were sent to EEO training.
Was she law enforcement?
Yes, she was in Eastern Drive.
Was that Bev Perry?
No.
Okay, all right. Okay, no worries. So,
anyway,
so three
so
of
went,
you,
we went
three
to
of China, you.
We went it and we went to the EEO training.
Okay.
And we came back because there was no EEO at Grand Canyon and there were problems and nobody had an avenue. They had to go to another EEO. Somebody had to find somebody in another park.
They'd
call Yosemite or they'd call Sequoia and they said, we have enough issues. We need our counselors here. So they trained us. We came back and I'm very particular about doing things well. So then I wrote everything down and then I created an EEO handbook for Grand Canyon National Park in case I fell off a cliff. You're the new counselor. This is what you do. This is who you're interfacing
with.
This is how you approach it. And it's still there to my knowledge. And I have a copy.
Cool.
So, so then I coming back, I was the lead EEO counselor and then I went to, and when we talk again, I will think of the person who it is.
Okay.
Or look it up.
Yeah.
And then we would, so now our names are posted in public places, like, you know, where all notices are posted. So if you have a problem, contact one of these 3 people.
Okay.
And
that's
so
nice because maybe, you know, maybe my next door neighbor is one of these 3 people and I've got a problem with their barking dog. I can go to one of the other 2.
Right, but the barking dog would be a law enforcement thing.
Oh, right. Okay.
Equal employment has to do with discrimination or harassment or an unwelcome environment.
Right. So bad example on my part, but I guess my point was if I have this harassment problem and it happens to be one of those 3 people that's the EEO person, I can go get another one. That was great.
Yeah. And so being the lead, I would often help with the others, especially writing up the contracts.
Okay.
So what would happen is you do these, and it was a collateral duty of mine. So if I ever got an EEO complaint, I went to my supervisor and said, I have an EEO complaint. Immediately, 20% of my time was allowed to be dedicated to investigating this.
Wow.
And looking into it, interviewing people who might have been, yes, I've been into that office, and I've seen that calendar and da-da-da-da, and, you know, and this is a very simple example. Usually it's much more involved than that.
Right.
Somebody getting unwanted advances, or somebody got promoted over somebody else, and it was obvious that they were not as qualified as the person of a different gender or something like that. And so, so the investigation went underway. I would often talk to people at region, which is the in charge of the national parks of a particular area, and I would bounce it at something very complex. I handled quite a few cases, actually.
Hmm.
And then I would keep J.T. Reynolds in the loop, let him know what region said, let him all that said. And,
okay.
And the deputy superintendent I worked with, J.T., he just happened to be the deputy superintendent when I was an EEO counselor. It could have been anybody that the park decided. But it had to be somebody high up in administration, because they ultimately made the final decision as to what it was, what was going to be satisfied.
Mm.
But the phrase is, what will it take to make you whole? So if for instance, I didn't voluntarily change my days off, and I was not a part of a union, and he just changed my days off, I could say maybe he did that because I was a woman. I don't think that would have been the case. So I wouldn't have had a case, and it would have been thrown out.
Okay.
Because it's, you know, because a man might have been changed as well. So you have to investigate to see if it violated one of the things that you are, as an EEO counselor, protecting. And then if it did violate it, how egregious it was. And you always ask the person, what do you want? Do they want back pay? Do they want a job in a different place? Do they want the calendar off the wall? What is it you want out of this that will make you say, I am satisfied with this? We use the phrase, make you whole, W-H-O-L-E. And then I go and I talk for hours with the deputy superintendent. We figure this out. I hammer out a contract. He looks at it. He says, good. I take the parties. It depends upon the situation, whether parties ever meet in front of me or in front of the superintendent, or if I just take it back to them and make it happen, or he makes it happen. There's so many different scenarios that in this particular situation.
Right. Fascinating. Maybe this is a good time to stop here, because I would like to ask you for your recollections about J.T. Reynolds. What was he like? And so does that, but this is fascinating discussion about EEO discrimination, and there's a framework in place to make this work. And I'm still kind of want to know how did it work? Did it work well or not? So maybe this is a good place to put a comma in this oral history. What do you think?
Yeah, I think that's good. The only other thing I want to add to this.
Please.
Every EEO complaint was 100% confidential.
Okay.
It always was binding to all the parties to never discuss it, or there would be serious repercussions.
Yeah.
Up to and including losing their position, their job.
Okay.
So if he took the calendar off the wall and went around bad-mouthing the woman, that person could be fired.
Oh, interesting. Okay, so it was sort of thing when there was corrective action made, that was it, you didn't talk about it again.
Right. People themselves could talk about it, but then they lose their anonymity.
Oh, I see.
So if you were part of a party of an EEO complaint, you were told not to talk about it.
Okay.
If everything was satisfied to your thing, to your satisfaction, at least not in a derogatory manner.
Okay.
Yeah. Excellent. So we'll pick it up, and I'll let you jog our memory for J.T. Reynolds when we come back.
That sounds fine. And with that, then, this will conclude Part 9. Grand Canyon Oral History Interview with Nancy Melody Meekum. Today is Wednesday, April 7th, 2021. My name is Tom Martin. And Nancy, thank you so very much.
Don't stop the button. Her name was Joan Chacon.
Aha. How do you spell Joan's last name?
C-H-A-C-O-N. I used to call her Joni Chaconi.
H-A-C-O-N.
C-H-A-C-O-N. I worked with her at Sequoia National Park, and she was a Desert View Ranger, just a marvelous person.
Nice. And she was the third EEO officer.
She was the one that went to training. I believe so. She went to the training as well. And cool. I believe there was somebody at the North Rim, but we're talking 20 years now.
Yeah. No, understood.
So.
Super.
All right.
Thanks, Nancy.